Hi, Dave.
Hello, Adam. First thing to do, I get to hide myself.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, whatever you need to do. I'm the same. I don't like looking at myself. I don't like hearing my voice either. It's very. I always think, oh, was that what I sound like? Was that what I look like to people? How are you?
Well, how should I put it?
Well, yeah. it's been a rough 2 years, hasn't it?
It's been a rough 2 years, and and now war in Ukraine.
Oh, it's... goodness, yeah.
Yes.
don't worry. We'll edit all the kind of like personal stuff out. No problem. Yeah. Have you been keeping your eye on current affairs and things? Well, I've not heard of the word doom scrolling before. I thought, oh, that's a new one. Normally, I'm quite savvy with these words.
Yes, I watch the news. I also go to RT.com for Russia Today.
I got it.
It used to be Russia Today. I think it's been rebranded. But yeah, the temperature feeling somehow one after, 2 years ago, like many people, I rebranded myself as a virologist, immunologist, and so forth. Okay. Now rebranding oneself as a political pundit and expert in international relations.
Virology. Yeah, we're living through big events in history. I can kind of appreciate how previous generations must have felt in World War One, World War Two, living through these big events. And I've also certainly during the COVID situation, I noticed some worrying changes in people's mood, and certainly with like some of my parents' friends, maybe like just two people living together or one person living together, I've noticed a definite downward trajectory of people's mental health. And that's what isolation does, doesn't it, really? That's why they use it as a kind of form of punishment or interrogation, so to say.
Yeah, and being encouraged to think of everyone as a potential plague bearer is not good.
It's not conducive to a high trust society, is it?
No, exactly. I mean, particularly as, this includes one's nearest and dearest. And if you're a politician, to be a successful politician, you need to be pretty paranoid, if not clinically paranoid. So I don't think the speculation about Vladimir Putin's mental health is necessarily all propaganda. Although in one sense it tallies with what we know of his views. I mean, he described the breakup of the Soviet Union as the biggest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. In another sense, he clearly, even in sort of terms of pure realpolitik, just completely misjudged this invasion. So, the extent to which the mental health, not just of ordinary members of the public, but politicians too, is being adversely affected by COVID. Speculative,
I wasn't aware of any kind of like analyses of Putin's mental health. That's quite interesting. Did you find anything quite revealing, or did anyone make any kind of accurate or inaccurate suggestions of what his mental state is like?
It's all sorts of speculation, rumour, disinformation, to be taken with a large pinch of salt. But if, for instance, one rumour, Parkinson's disease, if he were taking a dopaminergic drug to treat it, that would also quite possibly have psychological effects. Other suggestions, too. But yeah, particularly that in an autocracy, the health, the mental health of the leader is extremely relevant.
Yeah, I was going to ask about like the COVID situation or the Ukraine war, the Ukraine-Russia war, was through the lens of like a suffering abolitionist, and you kind of got there before me with the mentioning of dopaminergic. I was just thinking: is megalomania classed as a mental illness? Is it in the DSM-4? Is it? Wouldn't surprise me. They've got everything else in there, I think.
I mean, it's one of the signs of mania is grandiosity. It's one of the reasons why mania bipolar disorder has evolved, in that in certain circumstances it can be extremely adaptive, fitness enhancing. If the barbarians at the gate, if you can lead the charge to repel them and become a hero and reproductive opportunities, in terms of what's going on right now, essentially evolution designed coalitions of male primates to wage territorial wars of aggression against other coalitions of male primates. And so in that sense, what Putin and his regime are doing is textbook stuff. We shouldn't be so surprised, which doesn't make it any less upsetting and disturbing.
Absolutely. Do you think this could be finally the century that the human race reaches escape velocity out of that kind of these kinds of autocracies and male aggression, male centered conflict?
It would be nice to think so, but short of rewriting the genome, which isn't going to be done systematically this century, I fear there are going to be more wars, including quite possibly nuclear war. If we avoid it this time, sooner or later, if you have heavily armed nation states, we haven't abolished war. Nations are going to go to war with each other. Nuclear weapons are going to be used. Yeah. And no one can outline, plans for world peace. I've done it myself. It's unfortunately striking that first the League of Nations and then the United Nations were only set up in the aftermath of catastrophic world wars. And the kind of world government that I think, democratically elected world government that I think is ultimately going to come to pass, it's most likely to come in the wake of some catastrophic world war rather than to prevent it.
I think Elon Musk and Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos need to hurry up so that we can escape this planet as a tourist, or as refugees escaping this planet that's going to be torn apart by a nuclear war, which I hope doesn't happen, of course. But that's you got me thinking there when you were saying that. That's the problem with moral enhancement, certainly being one of the things talked about in transhumanism and futurism, is moral enhancement. But I think it falls into the trap of being a kind of deus ex machina, because the big problem with moral enhancement is people with certain morals or twisted morals will not want to volunteer for moral enhancement because these grandiose personalities are happy the way they are and they don't want to change. So the biggest roadblock to moral enhancement is that, I think.
Well, if there were consensus on on the nature of morality and what was the ethically correct moral system, there would be an extremely powerful, indeed compelling case for moral enhancement.
Yeah.
But given the sheer diversity of views on morality, one might find that some people taking a moral enhancement drug would actually, let's say, have the courage to act out their catastrophic convictions. Moral enhancement isn't straightforwardly a panacea, alas.
No. Do you think that's something that's only possible or technically feasible through genetic engineering or drugs or better class of more advanced and emerging drugs or psychopharmacological treatment?
Oh, good heavens.
Combination. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, a lot depends, you see, on what conception of morality one is trying to amplify. And if one is either a classical or a negative utilitarian, then promoting a greater ability to systematize, hyper-systematize, and behave sometimes in ways that are radically at variance with orthodox morality may be called for. Moral enhancement will mean something very different if you're a deontologist.
That's a good point. What morals do we want to enhance? Whose moral framework are we? When does it become like imposing your own morals onto others who might not share the same morals? And I suppose if you do that or engineer people's morality, it's kind of like computer programming, really. And I think it really highlights the problem of free will. Do any of us have free will, or are we always at the mercy of something that comes before it and then before it, or going all the way back to the birth of the universe? What was that word you said? Deontologist?
Yes. If you're a deontologist, let justice be done. Let's, if the heavens fall, what counts? Doing the right thing. You should not tell lies. Whereas, if you're a consequentialist, and the most famous form of consequentialism is utilitarianism, what counts? The consequences of one's actions. It's more complicated than that. It always is, yes, that utilitarians can adopt all kinds of rules of thumb and be deontologists in everyday life, and deontology can be consequentialized. Before talking of moral enhancement, it's necessary to be quite clear what it is one is going to enhance.
Yeah, it's a case of who gets to make those decisions. Maybe an AI, but then again, what if the AI is not so friendly? for the sake of discussion, what's the difference again between classical utilitarianism and negative utilitarianism?
Classical utilitarianism, most commonly associated with Jeremy Bentham, gives equal weight to maximizing happiness and minimizing suffering, which is intuitively very appealing if one wants to naturalize value and disvalue. But negative utilitarians think our overriding obligation is to minimize suffering. I mean, by all means, promote happiness, but negative utilitarians would walk away from Omelas, if you recall.
Yeah.
Le Guin's tale, City of Omelas, City of Fabulous Delight. Everyone has an absolutely wonderful time, and yet the existence of Omelas, for unexplained reasons, depends on the torment of a single child locked in the basement. Now, by classical utilitarian criteria, that's easily a price worth paying. The misery, the abuse of a child is a mere pinprick compared to all the happiness. But there are some people who would walk away from Omelas, and as a negative utilitarian, I would walk away from Omelas.
Me too. I would also walk away from Omelas. Our two Cascade Silt had some great thoughts about that. I've heard of the book, and I'm aware of the author, Sibylle Kaley-Gwyn, but I've not got around to reading it or any work by her yet. I'd definitely like to do that. I think it would be quite nice to assemble a list of suggestions of books to read if you're wanting to go into suffering abolitionism, or that could definitely be one of them.
One thing that really does need to be stressed, though, is that the abolitionist project is this goal of getting rid of suffering via biotechnology is not tied to negative utilitarianism or Buddhist ethics. You can be a classical utilitarian, but you needn't be any kind of utilitarian at all to actually support the abolitionist project. I mean, you can simply support the World Health Organization definition of health, which doesn't commit us to any particular ethical or meta-ethical theory. It just defines health as complete physical, emotional, social well-being, and assumes that's what we should be striving for.
Does that mean positive utilitarians are bad people and they're monsters? who would want to keep Omelas running?
Well, I've only ever met one positive utilitarian. Positive utilitarian would be someone who gave no weight whatsoever to suffering but cared only about happiness. I think he was probably being deliberately provocative. Much more common, though, are classical utilitarians. But both classical and negative utilitarianism have extremely morally counterintuitive implications. Question to consider, though, is whether the fact something is counterintuitive should be any more significant in ethics than it is in, let's say, quantum physics.
I would also think it was probably more of a thought experiment, positive utilitarianism, or being a provocateur, maybe. Are you allowed to say who it was, or was it keeping shtuck? But that also reminds me of Les Wrong and Yudkowsky, and I can't remember the title, but it was about getting dust specks in the eye. Like, I think a million or billion people having a dust in their eyes, and compared to someone in everlasting suffering being like tortured. I hate the T word, but it just reminded me of, I read a lot of stuff on Les Wrong that I thought was very morally counterintuitive as well. So I find myself disagreeing with a lot of what was written there.
Yes, this is also tied in with the views of those Les Wrongers on the nature of consciousness, AI, and goodness knows what else. If Miri Eliezer is correct about the alignment problem, and it's highly likely that there is going to be some kind of intelligence explosion, and the upshot of the intelligence explosion won't be aligned with the complicated values and disvalues of people. Most of the scenarios I've come across of, the so-called paper clippers, in which AGI decides to convert the world into the equivalent of paper clips, actually do align extremely well with negative utilitarian values, in that such scenarios eliminate suffering. But the negative utilitarian isn't committed to phasing out life and sentience. It's possible to create a world based entirely on gradients of intelligent well-being. And this is the version of negative utilitarianism that I argue for. Mm. But there are others that are, shall we say, more apocalyptic.
Yeah, yeah. So we have the technical feasibility, but culturally and socially, we're not quite there yet to even to use these tools correctly, or you know, kind of as suffering abolitionists, really.
Well,
blocks of societal, culturally.
Yeah.
Economic.
Thanks to revolution in biotechnology, it is now feasible in principle to draw up blueprints to get rid of suffering in, let's say, 100 years. I'm not saying precisely 100, could be 90, could be 100, 110. But yeah, if there were global consensus for phasing out the biology of suffering, we could be tweaking the genome, giving all prospective parents access to pre-implantation genetic screening, counseling, CRISPR genome editing, getting rid of factory farms, slaughterhouses, cultured meat, reprogramming the biosphere. Yeah, a lot of the stuff I've done has essentially really been technically laying out what will be involved. But there's the sociological dimension. What is and isn't politically, sociologically credible? And sooner or later, if one starts talking about genome reform, people are going to mention the E word.
EU.
Yeah.
Dot.
Eugenics. Now, clearly, any kind of project to get rid of all forms of involuntary suffering is far removed from the kind of racial hygiene of the first half of the 20th century, but absolutely, people like to shoehorn unfamiliar ideas into familiar categories. And the first thing, if one starts talking in this vein, people are like to think of is either Brave New World or eugenics.
The Brave New World argument all the time. The E word. I remember discovering a new word that was proposed as an alternative to eugenics, but without the load. And I think it was, my memory serves me, it was progenics. I can't remember where I found it or who first coined it, but it was progenics as an alternative to the rather offensive and loaded eugenics, of course. But I do wonder if the words such as progenics was more widely adopted, whether people would still just associate it with eugenics or maybe think maybe it's like
critics.
Critics
would use the E word. There is, you know, linguistic reappropriation. It's been done by various derogatory epithets for women, gay people, and the like.
Yeah.
Could it be done for the E word? But it would be a challenge. It's people, I won't say they're comfortable, but if one is talking the language of remediation, many, possibly most people would accept the use of gene therapy to tackle the well-recognized genetic diseases, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell disease, cystic fibrosis, and so forth. But choosing the pain thresholds and hedonic set points of our future offspring, people aren't ready for it yet. I mean, I think they could be, particularly, you know, anyone who does sign up to the WHO definition of health, which is nominally at least essentially all the nations of the world are signed up to a conception of health that is radically transhumanist. And the only way to get anything even vaguely approximating health as defined by the WHO is massive genetic engineering, as well as the more conventional health measures.
Yeah, and as you've said before, sexual reproduction is itself a genetic crapshoot, I think, you're describing it as that, which is even less controllable.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, if sexual reproduction were called genetic experimentation, people would be far more queasy about it.
Of course,
it's natural.
So the World Health Organization's definition of the word health is the official yardstick.
Complete physical, emotional, social well-being by the lights of the WHO. No sentient being in history has yet ever been healthy. Even transhumanists, even someone like me, I said I think we ought to be moving to an architecture of mind based on information-sensitive gradients of bliss, but that's not complete health. The need to be hedonic dips of well-being, even if well-being never sinks below hedonic zero, to retain critical insight, social responsibility. So we have an insanely ambitious definition of health that the WHO recently reaffirmed. And all nations are signed up to the WHO and its version of health. So it's the question is, how can we persuade people, how can we lobby the WHO to live up to its own commitments? Where are we going to find a greater Thunberg who will harangue the WHO?
Yes, because we spoke of the WHO and as a possible avenue and to approach them with this project and the ideas. An appropriate place to start would be introducing the WHO to stopping abolitionism and maybe changing the definition to be more inclusive of including lots of the things you talked about, maybe help them redefine the word health to be more encompassing what you listed.
Some technical glitch?
Oh, no problem.
No. Let me switch one or two things off, see if that solves the problem. Bear with me a second.
Yeah, no problem.
Right, let's see if that solves. Right, okay. Language matters, branding matters, and the beauty of the WHO definition is that it doesn't get involved in philosophical discussions about the nature of ethics or something. It's all done in terms of the language of health. Well, you consider something like the introduction of anesthesia, general anesthesia in the 19th century, although it was briefly controversial for 15 years, nonetheless, you know, its practitioners didn't need, for the most part, at any rate, to enter into the nature of value judgments, ethics, or anything like that. It was just so transparently obvious to most people when it was clear that anesthesia was possible that this was the way to go. And I would like to see the abolitionist project, under whatever label you're going to call it, good health for all as defined by the WHO, biohappiness revolution, paradise engineering, take your pick. I would like to see it go mainstream. Yeah,
me too. I think the intelligence explosion, it's unfortunate that intelligence doesn't always correlate with morality. So that seems to me an intelligence explosion would not be accompanied by necessarily by a morality explosion. And I mean, arguably, we are more intelligent than certain lower orders of animals, but we treat them worse than a lot of animals treat each other. It's just very troubling to me that intelligence doesn't correlate with greater intelligence doesn't correlate with greater morality, fortunately. But
yeah, I mean, a lot depends on how we conceive intelligence. If one conceives of intelligence in the very narrow, mind-blind way of IQ tests. I mean, IQ tests don't measure social cognition, perspective-taking prowess, ability to solve problems cooperatively, stuff like that. They measure only the autistic dimension of intelligence, which is important. Though I think one can argue that a full spectrum superintelligence that could impartially access all possible first person perspectives, as well as having off the scale autistic intelligence, then you would get advanced morality. Superintelligence, as conceived by some researchers, it's more of a super Asperger. And I say this as someone who has many Asperger friends. Aspergers have produced some of the greatest achievements of civilization. But nonetheless, it is a very distinctive cognitive style. And one shouldn't assume that superintelligence is going to be a kind of hypertrophied version of the extreme male brain.
Yeah, that's a good word, hypertrophy. I love new words. I really do. I would like. I'd certainly like to see organizations like the WHO using words like paradise engineering, biohappiness, full spectrum superintelligence on their websites or documents. That'll be a good sign. You mentioned marketing. How could the optics of the movement be improved? How can the project be more approachable and relatable? Because I thought perhaps by saving terms and words like abolition and put it on the back burner for a bit in favor of more digestible words like and terms and slogans like when I was thinking about the other day towards radically minimizing as much extreme involuntary suffering as possible, or anti-slaughterhouse legislation, or also anti-torture, which I think is reasonable enough. And more earthly, more grounded versions of slogans, normally associated with more far future, otherworldly ideas and goals.
Yeah, I respect people who single-mindedly focus on, take an extraordinarily important example, getting factory farms and slaughterhouses shut and outlawed, rather than some grandiose vision of getting rid of all forms of suffering, focus on one particular kind
step by step of
suffering. Nonetheless, as a regulative ideal, thinking of the long-term future of the planet, long-term future of the biosphere, I think it will be advantageous, whatever language one is going to use. Mm. You could say it's a Buddhist vision, if you like.
This
commitment to phasing out all forms of involuntary suffering. The involuntary, I sometimes omit it, but perhaps one should always, or almost always, include it to spike guns. What should be our time horizon? As I said, although one can talk about, I said, 100-year plan to defeat the biology of suffering, this is not sociologically realistic. Hundreds of years, perhaps. But I think it would be good to mainstream language for this goal, this vision.
I'm not sure if voluntary suffering exists. It seems to me that if someone is experiencing voluntary suffering, then maybe they're not suffering, but they're probably just enjoying pain in a more kind of hedonic way. But I'm reminded of
No, please.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a word used in the glossary of Robert Darust's Algosphere glossary, Algostat, I think it was, like a limiter or cap, limiting and capping, or creating a ceiling rather, where pains and suffering cannot exceed. Did you see that? I'm not sure if you've been on his website.
Yes. Before getting rid of any experience below hedonic zero, which is going to be technically possible, it makes sense to restrict any form of negative experience to just, you know, information signaling dips. And just as today, people with very high pain thresholds but who don't have congestion sensitivity to pain can go through life treating pain is just a useful signaling mechanism, and just as a very few people with extremely high hedonic set points can go through life pretty much always cheerful, but just a few dips so they respond adaptively to noxious stimuli. Getting rid of all forms of severe, moderate to severe suffering, but yeah, still keeping some stuff below hedonic zero, that is less ambitious than banishing all forms of experience below hedonic zero.
Absolutely.
But for the long term, though, as I said, I think it makes sense to get rid of all experience below hedonic zero in favor of gradients of intelligent bliss once we gain control of our reward circuitry, which is going to be feasible.
Yeah, I think one of the problems people have with these ideas is it's a bit like the Brave New World argument. It's one of these arguments that keep popping up over and over again, is like put your hand on a boiling kettle. If you didn't feel any pain or suffering, you'd burn your hand. But you try and explain that we could try and work towards a kind of a nociception without actual suffering, like a robot or a robotic prosthesis knows when there's acid and they recoil and put your hand away, but without any of the actual nasty warfare. Some people can't seem to get that for some reason.
Yeah, well, we need a more civilized signaling system. Yeah. And in one sense, the rise of silicon robots that don't have the nasty raw feels of suffering show that it's possible to have extremely intelligent behavior without the nasty raw feels.
Yes.
But a lot of people just can't conceive it will ever really be possible for biological humans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love the Algostat concept, because pain and suffering are, or can be, and rather unfortunately under negative circumstances, of course, pain and suffering can be valuable and have utility when in fight or flight situations, because their pain and suffering are tools like booster rockets to help ensure our survival and survival of genes so that they can be passed on. However, when one is immobile, trapped, isolated, cornered, imprisoned, or situations where neither fighting nor running away are even remotely possible, then neither pain nor suffering nor any negative valence would serve any useful purpose, except as sadistic glee in the person responsible for doing such things to others. They certainly don't serve any useful purpose to suffer to the sufferer if they cannot run away or fight. So something like the Algostat is urgently needed, I would say.
Yes, indeed. Another problem is so-called mixed states, which
are good and
bad aspects, and people who say they would want to retain some forms of suffering are often actually think, you know, something like a nostalgia, or some people into S&M or hot food or something like that. But essentially, no one values despair or agony. I mean, we'll never encounter an advanced alien civilization with an inverted pleasure pain axis. So although it might be simplistic to say that, yeah, everyone hates pain and values pleasure, yeah, one finds from from worms and insects to humans.
So we know futurism and transhumanism is comprised of many schools of thought, subcultures, movements with their own respective goals, so on, such as artificial intelligence, singularitarianism, longevity, immortalism on a more extreme end or side of longevity, biohacking, and so on. And of course, suffering abolitionism. Do you think suffering abolitionism is not as popular or as well known or as championed as much as some of those other examples?
Yes, most transhumanists are probably more focused on either super intelligence or super longevity rather than super happiness or the abolitionist project. It's to some extent, you know, however grandiose one's vision, one is talking quite often as a form of oblique autobiography, and for some people, essentially the big horror in the world is aging. Everything else is subordinate to defeating aging. Other people, for example, you know, who believe that we are on the brink of an intelligence explosion. If I thought sometime in the next few decades, you know, that AI was going to go foom, then this would cause a radical reevaluation of my priorities. Although I think a transhumanist civilization of the three supers, super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness, would probably most transhumanists would go along with it. A focus on suffering in particular, it's only a minority of transhumanists who prioritize it. And, you know, I hope one day the very existence of suffering will be forgotten. I hope one day that negative utilitarianism is regarded as an effective psychosis from a bygone era insofar as it's known about at all. But, as you know, I think overriding priority should be defeating suffering. And so though I'm as fascinated as anyone by developments in AI and radical life extension, ethically, the problem of suffering trumps everything else.
I agree, yeah. You have films about mind uploading like Transcendence starring Johnny Depp or malevolent AI like Terminator. So, many of those other cases of futurism have bled even into the mainstream, yet there are a minimum of works like films and stories about freedom from suffering, it seems. It's probably just, it might not make a good like fiction story. But certainly for me, like what you just said, it was a eureka moment for me. Where you feel like you have discovered something all-encompassing that threads through all spheres of knowledge, activity, endeavor, creativity. Suffering is everywhere. So what is more important than that? Like you say, I really do think that liberation from suffering is an ultimate value, a golden goal, or the very bottom of the rabbit hole even. And what I mean is many people work for money because money and financial security is the highest value for many people, and for others, money and financial security and stability are not the highest goals and values for other people because they go on to something higher, which they could use that money to invest in. And then higher still, people invest money into a project because they want to be remembered, they want to change the world, exert their will, and so on. So where those values are not even taken into consideration by those who just work for money and nothing more. So to help illustrate further, to free ourselves from suffering is at the top of Maslow's pyramid, or a bespoke version of it. But I agree with you, there might not be many things higher or more important than that, and might not be anything higher at all. It's certainly an all-encompassing, it's something worth giving your life to, like a kind of life's work. And also by the same token and following the same pattern, suffering abolitionism itself can be broken down into more sub-schools of thought like negative utilitarianism, effective altruism, and of course, interventions for wild animal suffering, like in herbivorization, welfare states for more intelligent, sentient animals like elephants and dolphins. And again, wild animal suffering seems to cause more controversy than, say, better living through chemistry, for example. Do you think of that? And maybe why do you think that is?
Well, better living through chemistry can be controversial, but yes, a lot of people, the first time they come across, the idea that we should be intervening in nature to reduce suffering, phasing out predation or something, they're incredulous. I mean, the idea isn't completely new, as you know, the book of Isaiah prophesies this world where the lion and the wolf will lie down with the lamb. Yeah. For many people, the food chain, it's a bit like the second law of thermodynamics. Essentially, it must be so. And until recently, at any rate, there wasn't a great deal of point in dwelling on the terrible suffering that exists in nature because there wasn't anything one could do about it. Mm. And the only possible intervention, like feeding hungry, starving herbivores in winter, that's not going to help wild animal suffering. It leads to population explosion in the spring and more suffering. It's only very, very recently that it's been possible to sketch out blueprints for minimizing wild animal suffering too. But it's not just a question, as we were touching on earlier, of devising blueprints that are technically feasible. They've also got to be sociologically credible, if not now, in 50 or 150 years hence. And that's why, although personally I would be very relaxed about species of obligate carnivore going extinct, being gracefully, non-violently retired via sterilance.
Mm.
I have instead explored the option of genetic tweaking and reprogramming, which is why it's fantastic, the initiative you've been involved in, herbivorizing predators. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Not least, it helps familiarize people with the idea that it may be possible. And it's quite a brave thing.
Even the name is quite brave. It explicitly lays out there.
it's much harder to deal with ridicule than it is to be with controversial. I didn't think the issue was going to be discussed in my lifetime, although I've.
Oh, really? Wow.
My scenario used to be essentially first humans, then cultured meat. Last stage of the abolitionist project would be, at least on Earth, reprogramming the biosphere. Wasn't prepared for the modest growth, things of Facebook groups and the like, focusing on the problem of wild animal suffering. One reason that not everyone is scornful about the prospect may be that one isn't actually asking people to give up eating meat. If one is talking about vegetarianism or veganism, this is very personal and very focused. Whereas simply signing up to minimizing and preventing wild animal suffering, even phasing out predation, there's no personal inconvenience involved, not even higher taxes or anything. That's perhaps unduly cynical. In spite of my being askew with timescales, I still find it very hard to imagine that we will ever systematically start intervening compassionate biology, compassionate stewardship, so long as humans are systematically abusing yeah. and human animals in factory farms and slaughterhouses, which I think that should be our
first, one, maybe.
Our first priority. But at the same time, it's important to have the debate about wild animal suffering now, not least so we don't waste time with misguided initiatives such as, you know, captive breeding programs for big cats and the like.
Yeah, it's the abolitionist project wanted to be done in steps and increments, kind of like a, you could say a positive slippery slope, or a positive one that goes upwards. Step by step and in increments. But of course, the problem is lots of other beings will suffer whilst, you know, the abolitionist project takes time to gain traction. It will be a necessity to do it in increments, because controversy could kill the project. But it's troubling, of course, because that pace will mean that lots of things will still suffer.
I agree. I mean, if we could all unite around the WHO vision combined with the technical tools to realize it, it would be very different. But in practice, there is going to be enormous resistance from bioconservatives.
My favorite wild animal intervention is the robots wearing lab-grown, cruelty-free meat soaked in catnip. I think it was Stan from HP who said it. Are you okay to leave it there, Dave? Because I'm just thinking it's getting late and I don't want to keep it too long.
Yeah, as I said, if there are any other topics you want to tackle, happy to do so. But yeah, essentially, I think hopefully there's some material there.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, brilliant. No, it was, I really enjoyed that. I think we got a lot of good. Got some good ideas and good discussions there. Yeah. Okay. Cool. I'll not keep you then. It was really good to speak to you again, Dave. You can message me anytime.
Thank you. As I said, you've seen me in very good form lately.
Oh, yeah.
In spite of the challenges. Yeah. The challenges of this decade. So do keep me posting. Congratulations again on your work with
Rising
Predators, and let's chat again
soon.
We needn't chat by wearing a hat of giving a interview or talk or anything like that. So
I'll probably speak to you again soon when we have a conversation with Dave K and the other reaction group. But, brilliant. Thanks again.
Great.
Thanks again, David.
Take care.
Good
night, Adam.